I remember the first time I came across in my reading the word tessellation. I thought it was beautiful, and upon looking it up in my dictionary, found that it means to form of small squares or blocks or tiles in an order of some kind, as forming a picture in a mosaic. Tessellation is the art or practice of tessellating, of forming a pattern or picture of small individual pieces. A good speaker is a tessellator. He fashions a mosaic in the minds of his listeners by placing one piece at a time until the picture is finally complete. Then he gives us a glimpse of the finished picture in his closing remarks. We might say that in his opening remarks, he shows us the matrix which gives order and form to a thing, which serves to enclose it. He shows us where the mosaic is going to be formed, the shape or need of that which is to be formed. Then, in order, one piece at a time, he fashions the picture for us. It's important when communicating with others that we keep things in order. We don't want it to be plodding or pedestrian, tiresome or boring, of course. Each of the small bits that we use to form the picture should have interest of its own, if at all possible. We've all heard the truly great storyteller who tells the story in such a way that each of the parts leading up to the punchline is hilarious in itself. By the time we reach the climax of the story, we're convulsed in helpless laughter. It was a mosaic, all right, and he placed the bits in their proper order so that we could follow him perfectly. But each of the bits was a work of art in its own right. The finished product is a masterpiece. Now, we're not all endowed with the rare and wonderful talent of a gifted and polished storyteller, but we can make our speech in the same way. The whole may be more than the sum of its parts, but its overall quality and integrity will depend on the quality and integrity of each of its parts. As we prepare our speech, we can prepare the parts themselves so that they follow a logical order and so that each of the parts is in itself of interest, importance, or humor. It's like writing a book. The book has, let's say, 12 chapters. Together, they follow a path or tessellation toward the conclusion, the idea behind the book itself. But each of the chapters must be of interest if we want the reader to finish. It's a very common sense idea, nothing at all new about it, but often a person with an idea for a talk will overlook the opportunity to make the journey just as interesting as the destination. And I think that's part of the responsibility of a good speaker. The cardinal sin of the communicator is to be uninteresting. It's the worst sin in selling, and that's what the speaker's doing. He's selling an idea or a theme or a story to his listeners. And it's his duty to be interesting in all parts of that story. And that's where burning the midnight oil comes into the picture. A good friend of mine told me the other day that he had accepted a speaking engagement to the local Rotary Club. He asked me if I had any ideas and went on to say that he would probably lie awake all night before the day he was to give the speech, worrying about it. I told him that was about the best way I knew of to ruin it. Think about it, of course. When we have a speech coming up, we can't help but think about it. It worries our mind like a puppy with an old shoe. I've got a commencement address coming up next Sunday. I told my friend to give it a lot of thought, remember to stick to a subject he was intimately familiar with, tie it to the interest of the members of the club. Then it's my habit to forget all about it and get a good night's sleep the night before the speech. Set the alarm clock to wake up early, earlier than usual. Get up, make a fresh pot of coffee, then sit down at your desk and outline the talk you're to give. The method works like a charm for me. I've given the talk a lot of thought. I've done my homework. I've got to do some good cooking, some good percolating in my subconscious. Then, by getting up early on the actual day of the speech, I find it flows out of my mind and onto the paper almost faster than I can write. And there, it's done. There's the idea. There are the tiles that fit in order into the picture. And finally, the complete picture. The whole is good. The parts are good. It will be a good, interesting speech. One last check to make sure the parts are in order. Do they lead in an interesting but unbroken tessellation to the complete picture I want to make? They do. Then I put the outline in my pocket and briefcase and try to forget about it until lunchtime. Now, during coffee at lunch, I will go over it again, perhaps adding something, maybe taking something out, the final touches. Then, all is set. Now, quite often, at lunch or dinner or at a conversational gathering before your talk, you pick up several ideas to incorporate into your talk, perhaps at the beginning, to better fit it into the group you're addressing. Sometimes I note these ideas on a separate sheet of paper or back of an envelope and put it with my notes on top, where I'll be sure to see it and remember it. Then, I do the best I can to make an interesting talk, keeping in mind that while I can take my subject seriously and my craft, I should never take myself seriously. I should keep a good perspective and a sense of humor. If you tend to be an orderly person naturally, you pick up after yourself, like to keep things in neat stacks and know where everything is, chances are you'll put your talk in the proper order without even thinking about it. But if you're the sloppy type, towel on the floor after a shower, leaving cabinet doors open, habitually late for meetings, you'd better take special pains with your speech. There, order is important. Thank you. As a Toastmaster, you should try to find a subject on which you're reasonably well-informed and should select some matter on which you have definite feelings and convictions. I don't think these two important points can be overstressed, most especially the latter, a matter on which you have definite feelings and convictions. You know, that's also a rule for good creative writing. If you want to transmit an emotional feeling or content along with what you're writing or speaking about, it's important that your subject be something that's very meaningful to you. Over the years, I've had many people write and visit me to tell me that they want to become public speakers, that they have a tremendous urge to get up before a group of people and talk. I always ask them the same question. What do you want to say? As often as not, it's answered with a long pause and a thousand-yard stare. They want to be speakers, but they don't have anything to say. My suggestion has been for them to get excited about something and then start talking about that. I only make speeches on subjects in which I have a deep personal interest and to which I've devoted many years of reading and research. When a program chairman suggests that I talk on a subject of his selection and it's something in which I have no particular interest, I decline. Maybe that makes me less than a true professional speaker, but unless I've got something I want to talk about, I don't want to talk at all. May I suggest that you do the same? You'll seldom, if ever, be a boring speaker on something in which you're deeply interested, or something that moves you, that's important to you. If you give the idea some thought, you'll find there are several, indeed a whole spectrum of subjects in which you're very much interested. From your career to your hobbies and sports, I know one of America's most famous dentists who can lecture with enthusiasm on bone fishing, but he's also lectured all over the world, including in Russia, on his pet subject, which is occlusal rehabilitation. He's my old friend and fishing partner, Dr. L.D. Pankey, and his seminars for dentists are famous all over the world. This is a subject that can make all of us jump up and down and get excited about. There's something we do or believe in that we want to tell other people about, and perhaps get them interested in the same thing. As long as we follow the general rules of putting a speech together and stick to our pet subject, we'll make interesting speeches. We'll be asked to come back. In preparing a speech, I'm of the stewer variety. That is, as the day of the speech approaches, I find it difficult to get it out of my mind for very long periods. As I've mentioned in an earlier message, it tends to worry my mind like a puppy with a slipper. The day before my speech, my mind is turning over a number of ideas, and I'll begin to put a folder together for that particular talk. Pick the theme of your speech and write it out in one sentence or two. On it hangs the opening and the closing of your talk. Next, make a general outline according to your own system and plan as to timing. If the speech is to be for Toastmasters and you need a few extra minutes, notify the Toastmaster of the day in advance. But with a little extra effort, you can cover virtually any subject matter in the regular time allowed. It takes more work. Short speeches are harder to prepare and deliver, as I'm sure you know, than the long, rambling kind, which are dreaded by everyone but the speakers. And after you've got your outline together, rehearse. You don't want to commit the speech to memory, word for word, but you do want to get the sequence of your outline well in mind, so that you can comfortably move from one picture to the next as your picture forms in the minds of your listeners. Remember to carefully avoid anything at all that will appear artificial and affected. Be natural. You have something to give that's unique. Give it in your own way. As to gestures, well, I feel that the proper gestures will come of their own accord, especially with experience, as you lose yourself in your subject. When you're speaking to a friend or loved one about something important, you don't need to be concerned about gestures, yet chances are you gesticulate almost constantly. Let them come naturally, and they'll look natural. Force them, and they'll look forced and wooden. If you relax, your habits will take care of your gestures for you. You can forget all about them. If you use a lectern, for heaven's sake, don't lean on it. You can rest after your speech. Stand erect. If you want to rest your hands lightly on the lectern from time to time as it comes naturally, that's fine. But don't grip it as a barrier between you and your audience. Don't play or fool with it or with anything else. It's a distraction. And soon your audience is so enwrapped in whatever your hands are doing, they're not even listening to you. Forget your hands, and they'll take care of themselves, as they have a habit of doing all day long. Look at your hands now. What are they doing? See, no one's conscious of them. Forget them. And of all things, don't rock forward on the balls of your feet. I know a speaker who does that, and it's the most disconcerting thing I've ever seen. Keep in mind that you, as a person, should be only the backdrop. It's what you're saying that's important. Think of yourself as you think of the well-dressed person. The clothes of the truly well-dressed person are a background compliment to him. They're never of special notice themselves. Just as a well-dressed man would never wear a tie or jacket that calls out in a loud and raucous voice, "Look at me," the good speaker does nothing to distract from the thoughts, the ideas he's trying to get across. He tends to disappear as his thoughts fill the minds of his listeners. Unnatural movements of any kind destroy that. Be yourself, but dress simply and conservatively, unless the nature of your speech demands otherwise. My old pal Parky Parkinson of Kansas City, who's made several thousand speeches in his time, wears a red tie. It's his trademark. But a red tie with a conservative suit and dark jacket looks fine. If it had a picture of a rocket ship on it, well, that would be a distraction, or low class, as an old friend of mine used to say. To recap briefly, speak about what's important to you. Your anger or enthusiasm or interest will come through and infect your audience. Spend some time in preparation and prepare an outline, the points of which you make a point of learning. I frequently use a small list of points I want to make in the order in which I want to make them. And be natural, unless you've got some bad natural habits like the man who rocks up on the balls of his feet. Your friends in Toastmasters will quickly disabuse you of any bad habits you might have. And dress for the occasion with conservative good taste, unless the subject matter calls for a special outfit. Thank you. Visual aids, if they're called for, can be tremendously effective if they're handled properly. My good friend Dr. Derm Barrett, the well-known management consultant from Canada, arranges his visual aids well before the people come to the room in which he's to speak. Each of the aids is covered, and they're placed at strategic vantage points around the room or stage, depending on the size of the audience. They have printed on them in big, legible letters very important points Derm is going to make during his talk. They're points he wants to emphasize and give his audience a chance to make notes on. It's tremendously effective. I've sat enthralled during his talks on good management, management by objectives and time control, and made voluminous notes from his visual boards around the room. He'll have a main point in very large printing at the top of a board, then the lesser or substantiating points listed under it, 1, 2, 3 order, and so on. If you use slides or an overhead projector, make certain that the printing on the slides is large enough for the people in the back of the room to read. Keep in mind that not everyone has the vision of a peregrine falcon. I've sat in the back of the room and developed a splitting headache from trying in vain to read small typescript or small print on the screen during a slide presentation. Walk to the back of the room and see if someone not familiar with your slides can read them with ease. You should check the microphone the same way. Strive for simplicity. put only on visuals information that is required to be on visuals or helpful to your audience, such as statistical material, main points of your talk, and so on. Make sure you follow a consistent style and develop a smooth continuity. Remember that word tessellation. You want to place one interesting tile after another until the picture is complete. Make the composition of the visual pleasing and easy on the eyes, but that can be done without expensive artwork. You can do it yourself. Go easy with colors unless you have to make a special effect or want to throw in a little variety to grab their attention. And it's a good idea to introduce your visuals before springing them on the audience, unless, again, you want to shock or surprise them in some way. The simpler the visual aids are, the better as a rule. But that's not always possible, of course. If your presentation is a new heart operation or a discussion of the wheel assembly of a new jet aircraft, it's not all that easy to keep simple. But the simpler, the better. Visuals are not meant to confuse or impress people. They're an additional tool in the business of communication, and they can be wonderfully effective if they're needed and properly done. If funny visuals are used from time to time to add to the interest of your presentation, be sure they're secondary to your message, unless you're making a funny presentation. Humor should be a supportive adjunct to a presentation. It should have some kind of relationship to your subject so that it's the subject you're talking about that will remain uppermost in the minds of your listeners. In determining whether or not you should employ visuals in your presentation, you should ask or might ask this question. Will it help me do a better job of communicating, of transferring the subject in order and intact from my mind to the minds of my listeners? If so, use visuals. If not, forget them. A large pad of paper with a heavy marker can be effective. For this, you need a lavalier microphone, one that hangs around your neck so that when you move to the big pad, your microphone will go with you. That's not necessary if you're speaking to a very small group and they can clearly hear you without a mic. Turn your head toward them when speaking, however, or they'll miss what you say. If you use this method of illustration, remember to print or sketch large enough so that everyone, especially the people in the back of the room, can clearly see and understand what you're up to. Print or sketch very large, remembering that some people have difficulty seeing, just as people have difficulty hearing. If you're a good printer or cartoonist, this is an especially effective ploy. If you can't print very well, it would pay to practice or have your cards made up ahead of time and kept covered until you need them. Action of that kind adds animation and movement to your presentation, both desirable when they're a part of the presentation. Getting a beautiful and shapely girl to turn the pages of your large pad or board presentation is an exercise in futility. Everyone will be looking at the girl and ignoring your posters and your material. Should I use visual aids? Will they add to my presentation? Will they help me do a better job of communicating? If so, fine. If not, forget them. Thank you. There's no such thing as an unimportant speech. Some are more important than others, perhaps. I imagine that addressing the joint houses of Congress or the United Nations General Assembly might be considered more important than a Monday morning sales meeting, but the principles of the act remain the same. You are there to impart useful or important information in an interesting and memorable way. The opening, the middle, and the end should be much the same in structure, and you have listeners. We're all familiar with the axiom of show business. There are no small parts. There are just small actors. To the good actor, even the smallest part will receive his very best, and I think that's also true with professionals of all kinds. In speaking before a group of people, it's important that you're involved with your subject matter, as we've brought out before, that you spend a lot of time with it and feel comfortable with it. Approach your presentation with the proper attitude, the attitude of calm command. You're in charge. And while you should keep your sense of humor and your proper perspective, remembering that while you can take your subject and your act seriously, you should not take yourself seriously. Look at your audience and see them as individuals and speak to them as individuals. Project your voice so that it will comfortably reach the people in the last row. If you use a microphone, get within range of it, without crowding it, so that your voice may be distorted and you pop your peas. I made a speech in New York recently, and prior to my being introduced, an official of the meeting stood to make a couple of important awards. These awards involved giving a background and explaining the achievements of the people receiving them. But the speaker stood much too far back from the microphone. He gave the impression that he didn't know the mic was there. The result was that no one, not even those of us at the head table, were able to clearly hear what he had to say. He was talking to himself. It was a shame, especially so, since what he had to say was so important to everyone concerned, and especially to those who were being honored. What could have been a memorable occasion was a complete bust. Why didn't the man in his 40s know how to use a microphone? Why did he think that his voice without the mic would carry to the audience? Yes, someone should have told him no one could hear him. If I'd been within range, I would have, but no one did. The good speaker, like the good golfer, has to do a number of things correctly all at the same time if he's to have a successful shot. He should be prepared, no matter how unimportant the affair might seem to him. He should know his subject. He should have the right attitude, not say too much. He should project his voice, or if he's using a microphone, use it properly and not fade in and out as he moves about. He should enunciate his words clearly and watch his rate of delivery, not too fast, not too slow. He shouldn't worry about occasional stumbles or slips of the tongue. He should gesture naturally, appear confident, and be interesting. Yes, it sounds like a big order. It is a big order. But it's not a bit tougher than making a good golf shot. It takes time and practice. Until one day you don't have to think about anything at all except the people and your subject, and you'll make a great speech. Can you imagine a golfer standing so far back from the ball that he can't reach it? Or so close that he has to swing at his feet? Can you imagine a good golfer aiming in the wrong direction or varying his club and effort with the distance of the shot to be made? No, he's natural. He's comfortable, unhurried but not dawdling, and he knows the game. It's true that there are some audiences we'd rather speak before than others. Some make us a bit tense. Others warm us with their enthusiasm and hospitality. We feel right at home with them. Speaking before your good friends and cohorts at Toastmasters is one thing, even though you know they're being critical and watching for mistakes. A church group is different, as is a service club or professional organization. Speaking before attorneys or physicians is different from speaking before an insurance salesman or a union meeting, and each group will affect you slightly differently. Some are cool and a bit distant and give you the initial impression that they're not at all sure they're glad they have to listen to you. Quite often you're going on late. The dinner took forever. The service people were slow. The people had been sitting a long time and they're restless and in need of the restroom. There was too much business, reading of minutes, election of new officers, each of whom had to make a speech of his own. You're tired. It's been a long day. And after the meal and all that business of the meeting, you suddenly find that you've lost all interest in what you were going to talk about. You wish you were home. Anywhere but there. You dread the thought of having to stand up and make a speech. And that's when you remember the line, "There are no small parts, just small actors." That's where they separate the professionals from the amateurs. Because you can get up and make a speech that will hold the real interest and attention of every person in the room, and they'll be sorry to see you stop. Don't let that stop you from stopping, however, and they'll give you a standing ovation. Well, then it's all worth it, isn't it? You go home satisfied and glad you did such a fine job. It's not such a bad business after all. And isn't it great to know how to deliver a good speech? Thank you. Probably one of the worst characteristics of a thoughtless speaker is his inability to read the reaction of his audience. As with the man I mentioned who was standing too far back from the microphone, no one could hear what he was saying, but he remained oblivious to the many signals the audience was giving him. True, they weren't standing up and yelling at him or cupping their ears with their hands, but he should have been able to read their restlessness, their looking at each other, the occasional shaking of heads. They weren't getting it, and he was totally oblivious to the fact. By looking at the faces of your audience, you can usually tell whether or not you're doing a good job. Not every time, by any means. I've seen people in my audiences many times who appeared to be outright hostile to what I was saying, who seemed to be trying to tell me by their expressions that I was a blithering idiot. Yet I've learned over the years that it's often these same people who come up to the head table afterwards with the most profusive compliments and expressions of gratitude. They just happen to look like that. They wear customary frowns and their mouths turned down at the corners as though they had just bitten into a dill pickle. That's the way they look. The best indicator by far in my book is the silence, or lack of it. People in groups are normally noisy. Even when they're not talking, if you shut your eyes and listen, you can imagine that you're deep in a jungle filled with strange creatures. The snorting, coughing, blowing of noses, clearing of throats, scraping of chairs, sliding of feet. We're noisy creatures, we humans. And our noise diminishes and stops completely only when we're very much interested in something. Only when we're trying to hear something very clearly. Then, we're totally silent. And that's the feedback you're mainly looking for. Silent attention. It's the best indicator in the world that you're succeeding as a speaker. We've all heard the expression, he held the audience in the palm of his hand. I don't go along with that. It's his subject and the way in which it's delivered that does the job. Nor are we, nor will anyone get absolute silence during an entire speech. People are going to make a certain amount of noise. As someone suddenly has to cough or blow his nose or knocks over something, I've had sounds come from audiences you wouldn't believe. And no speaker, no matter how accomplished, is going to do a perfect or even near-perfect job every time. Even Jack Nicklaus loses tournaments. I saw him shoot in the 80s one time at Pebble Beach, and no matter how good you become at judging what the so-called silent audience is trying to say to you, how they're reacting to your speech, you're going to be better on some days, worse on some days, bad on some days, and absolutely magnificent on some days. If you can hit a high good average, you're doing a good job. But sometimes you don't feel well yourself. You're just down. And even when you give it all you've got, it's not going to be as good as it will be on days when you're up, when everything's right. Keep in mind, too, that there may be one or more people in the audience who do not react well to you and what you're saying. Don't keep looking at them. Look at the people who agree with you. It's better for your morale. But it's good to be aware that you have people in your audience who are unimpressed. It makes you try to do better. If someone falls asleep while you're talking, don't take all the blame. He probably needs his sleep. I've been asked many times what I think about the learning while you sleep techniques we've heard of from time to time. You're supposed to put a speaker under your pillow and listen to tape recordings while you're asleep. The theory is that you'll actually learn the material being listened to. My response is that I used to fall asleep occasionally in school, but I don't remember learning anything. If you've been doing much public speaking, you remember how you felt the first time someone in your audience stood up and walked out of the room. Your stomach dropped out. A dry constriction grabs the back of your throat. Often the new speaker will be so flabbergasted and surprised you'll stop talking, stunned. It hadn't occurred to him that someone might just get up and walk out of the room for any one of 10,000 excellent reasons. He may have to keep an important engagement. In fact, I've had thoughtful people come up to me before a speech and tell me that they would have to leave before I finished. The hardest thing for a beginning speaker to get used to is that people have lives to live, which they consider more important than listening to a speech, no matter how interesting. And when they have to do whatever it is, they must rise and quietly walk out of the room. It does not mean that they're walking out because they don't like your speech or because they're in angry disagreement with you. Haven't you ever had to leave a speech before it ended? I have. Yes, but it's always disconcerting. And those of us who are extremely sensitive to criticism will always feel a stab of self-doubt when we see a deserter get up and leave. It is not feedback, however, necessarily. It can be, but if you're not on an extremely controversial subject involving politics or religion or a sensitive local issue, chances are the deserter simply has to leave for personal reasons, and is no reflection whatever upon your relations. In fact, he's usually embarrassed to have to make such a stir. Well, the whole idea of this message is to help us be aware of and sensitive to, but not too sensitive, to audience feedback. An audience is responding to the speaker at all times. They respond with their attention or the lack of it, with their body movements, with sounds like a zoo at midnight. They're human beings with all kinds of problems you and I don't know about. But they're capable of being completely interested and entertained, and when that happens, they will respond as human beings have responded since the dawn of human history. They'll laugh in all the right places. They'll be moved by sadness and poignancy and will cry at the right places. And they'll be absolutely silent when you have their complete interest. Don't concern yourself with trying to win every member of the audience, especially if your subject is one of social criticism. If you're indicting modern education, you're not going to throw the teachers in your audience into paroxysms of helpless laughter. No matter what your subject may be, you're bound to have listeners who are not in agreement with you, unless you're giving them pure, unadulterated pap. Trying to win over every member of the audience is an impossible and thankless task. The important thing is your subject and what you're trying to say. You're not there to please your audience, necessarily. You're there to inform them. And if somebody jumps up in a huff and storms out of the room in very obvious objection to what you're saying, don't worry about it. Remember, there were those who disagreed with wise, kind Socrates. Don't attempt to manipulate your audience. Don't play God. Say what you have to say in the very best way that you can say it. Close, thank the nice people, and sit down. You will instantly know how good you were by the response. If they leap to their feet as one person clapping and shouting approval, try to get a quick picture of it, because the chances of it ever happening again are very slim. It does happen, but don't ever try for it. Remember what you're trying to do, and do it the best you can. Learning to watch for audience reaction and feedback is the mark of a sensitive, conscientious speaker. I think they're the best kind, and I'm sure you will be one. Thank you. The title of this message is, Who Do You Think You're Talking To? It's bad grammar. It should be, Whom Do You Think You're Talking To? But it's an old American pre-combat question. I remember being a new kid in school when I was in high school on the football and basketball teams and thought I was something special. I became uncomfortably aware that I was under the searching stare of a boy in the next row. I turned and looked at him. He didn't blink an eye. He just went on regarding me as though I were a specimen unearthed on a scientific expedition of some sort. I gave him the famous line, What do you think you're looking at? Whereupon, without a bit of hesitation and in a maddeningly calm voice, he replied, Not very much. I've saved that line, and if I'm ever asked that question by some churl or boor, I'll let him have it. The question, who do you think you're talking to, is often asked in the same spirit of burgeoning belligerence. It's an indication that we've overstepped that person's threshold of tolerance. We've offended him in some way. Now, I mentioned in an earlier message the occasion in which an entire audience stood up and walked out of the room, leaving the speaker a room full of empty chairs. He had offended their intelligence. He had spoken to them as though they were wayward children, without even the beginning rudiments of an education. The speaker was an insensitive bore who had not taken the measure of his audience. Quite often I've been on a program containing more than one speaker and have heard speakers, especially those exceptional salesmen who've been asked to speak to other salesmen, address their audience as though it were comprised of beginning nincompoops. They fail to realize that sitting out there in that audience were some very successful people, men and women who had achieved the very top of the selling profession. What's more, there were dozens, possibly hundreds of other people in the audience who were quite successful in their work. People who were supporting families and sending kids to college, who had read most of the books and heard most of the speeches over the years. To speak to such people as though they were beginners is to thoughtlessly insult them. They're deeply offended by such unthinking speakers, and they're saying silently, Who do you think you're talking to? Well, the purpose of all of this is to suggest that we never underestimate our audience. People are usually a lot smarter than the casual observer might give them credit for being. And it's a good idea, if you're going to pass along some information, to precede it with some kind of thoughtful disclaimer. I often use one that goes something like this. We all need reminding. Will Rogers said that none of us is smart enough to remember everything he knows, and so I'm going to remind you of a few basics here today that our busy world sometimes tends to cause us to lose sight of. You know, when you go to your golf pro because your game is beginning to slip a bit, he seldom tells you anything new. He simply reminds you again of a few basics which, when remembered, help us play a much better game. Well, that's my job here today, to remind you of a few basics that we tend to lose sight of. Now, the word remind carries with it the connotation that the people in your audience already know what you're going to say. It means you think they're as smart as you are, which in all likelihood is true. It's a simple way of giving your audience credit for having brains and experience. It disarms them. They can relax now and enjoy the speech. No matter what you say, even if it's something completely new to them, they can comfortably act as if they already knew it. You're not putting them down. You're not preaching to them. You're on their own level. You're one of them. You're on their side of the desk or podium. You're learning or being reminded with them instead of pontificating at them. And there's an important difference. Nor should we harangue our audience to do as we have done. There are many ways to a given destination. You've taken one way. Others may choose other routes they prefer. I remember how one speaker who was deeply religious offended his audience. Being a very religious man, his program for success involved getting up very early in the morning, and after running a mile and taking care of his office work, which also involved outlining his plan for the day, he would attend church every morning of the week. "And that's the way you do it," he belabored the audience. "That's the only way you're going to succeed in this business," he would yell at the top of his voice. Well, he offended his audience. He might have also caused some young people to doubt that they could succeed in any other way. He confused his way with the only way. I think it's a great idea to rise early and run a mile before breakfast. It's also a good idea to make your plans for the day, make a list of what needs to be done, and get the details out of the way. And certainly, for the deeply religious, going to church every morning could be an inspiring way to begin the day. But none of these things is essential to success as a human being. It all depends on the person. Some very successful people get up quite late, never exercise, never go to church. He should have said, "This is my way," instead of, "This is the only way." To the intelligent people in his audience, he made himself ridiculous. To the beginners, he was confusing and perhaps frightening. He was like the foreman at the plant on the morning that a new employee shows up for work who says, "Now pay careful attention. This is the way it's done around here." It shuts out all creativity. It slams the door on improvement and innovation. He should have said, "This is the way we do this particular job. If you can come up with a better way, we're interested." I remember reading someplace that no matter how certain we are of something, the odds are at the very best about 80% that we're right. It's so much better to say, "Now I've found that this system works wonderfully for me. Perhaps if you're so disposed, you'd care to try it." Never slam the door so that the people in your audience are left with no alternatives. When you've been asked to speak, you are, in effect, the guest of the audience. And the situation calls for good manners. If you're called on to give an invocation, it's important to remember that there are probably people in the room of different faiths, so that it's important not to be too specific. A general, all-faiths kind of invocation is best. The definition of a gentleman is that people are never uncomfortable or embarrassed in his company. And that's why the knowledgeable speaker never tells off-color jokes. I've heard jokes from people at the microphone that have made me squirm in my seat, and I spent 8 years in the U.S. Marine Corps. I've heard stories like that when women were present. It's unforgivable. It's an execrable taste. It's low class. Even if women aren't present, many men are deeply offended by dirty jokes. And there's a simple way to never offend in such a matter. Never, ever tell an off-color joke. Unless it's extremely mild and in good taste and has a definite connection with the proceedings. No one has to take unnecessary chances to be funny. The funniest situations are never embarrassing to tell or to listen to. Well, to sum up, don't make any assumptions about the people in your audience. If you must assume something, assume that they're all different, which they are, and every bit as smart and well-informed in their way as you are in yours. We used to have a saying in Chicago advertising, "Never underestimate the consumer. She's your wife." Thank you. There's an old story about a farmer working in his fields who was hailed by a passing stranger. After exchanging greetings, the stranger said, "I'm planning to settle up ahead in the next town. What are the people like up there?" And the farmer asked, "What were the people like where you came from?" "They were terrible," answered the stranger. "They complained all the time. They were miserable to talk to and to do business with. Very unfriendly." "You'll find the people in the next town are the same way," the farmer said. And the stranger rode on, shaking his head in his unhappiness. Soon another stranger came by and, by coincidence, asked the farmer the same question. "What were the people like in the town you came from?" the farmer again asked. "They were wonderful people. Warm, genuine, and friendly," the stranger said. "You'll find the people in the next town are exactly like that," replied the farmer. And the same good advice applies to audiences. They will respond to our attitude. It's uncanny the way an audience can sense the true feelings of a speaker. It's as though the speaker and his audience were connected by invisible wires. They cannot know what's bothering him unless there are visible manifestations of nervousness or stage fright, but they sense that all is not right, and they become wary, on edge. Every speaker of quality, I believe, suffers from nervousness before a speech, the degree of it depending upon the makeup of the audience he's to face. But like most, I feel that's a good thing. It puts us on our mettle. We get up for the speech, as they say, and we work hard at doing a good job. I find it helps me a great deal if I can develop a kind of love for the audience before I begin to talk. Now, by love, I mean a feeling of agape, which originally meant a feeling of love between Christians, but which can certainly include all people regardless of their religious leanings. It's a feeling of brotherhood. After all, we all belong to the same club, the same species. Our humanity is our membership card. And we can develop a feeling of liking, of being glad we're there at that moment. And I believe that feeling is transmitted to the audience. Audiences, I think, like most people most of the time, seem to dwell in a kind of neutral. They're not particularly negative, nor are they particularly positive. They're waiting to respond to whatever stimulus we provide. If it's good, if it's warm and positive and contains a feeling of love or liking or brotherhood, they seem to sense it and respond in a positive way. We've all seen cases, hundreds, thousands of times, in which a well-known, very funny comedian comes on stage. The audience knows he's very funny, and they begin to laugh even before he says anything particularly funny. He could say simply, "Hello," and they'd laugh. They are preconditioned to laugh. They're ready to laugh. They can hardly wait to laugh. His act is a big success even before getting started. Well, we don't always have that kind of preconditioned audience when we enter a room or appear at the microphone. We're often an unknown quantity. With time and experience, we can achieve the preconditioning of an audience, and it makes it much easier and better. But in the beginning, we have to create a good mood within ourselves if we want a favorable initial response from the audience. By liking your audience before you begin, you set the stage, which is so important, for what you have to sell. We might call it the package in which you and your words are to appear. It's an important part of marketing, as we all know. Without it, with a cold or negative audience to overcome, it's much tougher. Remember the famous laws of physics that go, a body in motion tends to remain in motion until acted upon by an outside force. Conversely, a motionless body tends to remain motionless. It's harder to get a motionless body started than to keep a moving body moving. There's a book out which has a title that goes, if I remember correctly, The First 4 Minutes. I may be wrong in the actual words, but that's the idea of the book at any rate. The book talks about the importance of that first impression. We can overcome a poor or average first impression with a good speech and wind up a big success, but it's a lot better to begin a winner. So, like your audience, even if it's hard for you at first. Liking your audience will go a long way toward dispelling nervousness and stage fright. We enjoy talking to people we like. It's fun, and we can have a good time doing it. Most people are nice people. They want the same things you and I want. They want to enjoy your speech. They're looking forward to hearing you. Actually, you've got everything going for you. There's no reason in the world to be fearful or consider the people in your audience hostile toward you. The fact that they're not all wearing big friendly smiles isn't important. They want you to succeed. They want to enjoy your speech. You can enjoy it with them if you begin with the right attitude, as you probably know. That word attitude, you know, has been called the most important word in the language. It's magic. It can work wonders and overcome tremendous odds. And people tend to respond favorably toward a good attitude. It's believed and often said that if you get to know anyone really well, you'll like him. I don't know if I go along with that completely, but I'm sure it's true in the overwhelming majority of cases. Keep in mind that there's a human tendency in all of us, but the occasional 100% 18-karat boor, to underestimate ourselves and to unconsciously give more credit than we give to ourselves to others. We're a lot better than we tend to consider ourselves, and when it comes time to stand up there on your own and make that speech, well, it helps to muster confidence that you're there for a good reason. The people are good people. They want you to succeed, and they'll do all they can to respond favorably to you if you have the right attitude toward them. So like your audience. Remember, you've been in a few audiences yourself. You know how you feel. Thank you. Meetings are often preceded by cocktail hours. It is perhaps an unfortunate custom. To have a few drinks before dinner and good fellowship is fine. To have a few drinks before dinner and good fellowship followed by an after-dinner speaker is not necessarily a good idea, but it is a custom, and all speakers are familiar with it. After three or four drinks and a big meal, few human beings, especially after a day's work, are alert and in happy anticipation of a speech. Most would much rather head for home in a comfortable bed after some bicarbonate of soda and a short lecture from a wife on staying out late and drinking during the week. The cocktail hour puts the speaker in a unique and particularly dangerous situation. If he has a couple of drinks with the boys, then dinner, followed by the official business of the club, he would much rather head for home in a comfortable bed, too. Alcohol is a depressant. It slows us down. It dulls the critical faculties. There is no way to make as good a speech after a couple of drinks as there is without a couple of drinks. For me, drinking before a speech is outright disaster. Standing on your feet and making an interesting and informative talk to a group of tired and slightly smashed human beings calls for every bit of alertness and sharpness you can muster. Drinking before dinner is absolutely out of the question for the speaker. If you want to have a couple of drinks with the boys before dinner, don't accept a speech. If you've accepted a speech, make the sacrifice. Don't have a drink until after the speech. Even one drink will dull the edges of your talk. You'll reach for a special word and it won't be there. You know it's in the room someplace, and your mind gropes frantically for it, but it must be hiding behind the sofa, and you find yourself covering up for it. The zest, the sparkle, the bright, clean edge of your talk is dulled and sicklied over. Right. You shouldn't have had that drink. But you want to be relaxed. You want to be smiling and casual. One of the boys. So you have a drink. After a drink, your confidence increases, and you begin to think that you're going to make the best speech of your life. If that much confidence can be mustered with one drink, two will surely be even better, and sure enough, you feel even more confident until the time comes for you to stand up and make your speech. It's then that you realize you've made a serious mistake. You're not only dull instead of sharp, but you've lost all enthusiasm for the talk, all real interest. That happened to a good friend of mine one time. He had been selected for a very important position with his company, a large national corporation, and he deserved it. There was a special banquet at which two or three executives were to be officially promoted before their peers. Each was expected to make a short acceptance speech. My friend, a quiet, very good man, and an excellent manager, was frankly very nervous about getting up at the head table and making a speech, even a short one. The president and chairman of the board were there, along with other top executives. The room was filled with the cream of the corporation. As usual, there was the traditional cocktail party before dinner. My friend, very nervous about the whole thing, down to martini. It made him feel so good he had another. That gave him so much phony confidence he had a third. And when the time came, after the president's glowing comments about him and news of the new promotion, for him to stand, walk to the podium, and make his short speech of acceptance, my friend was too drunk to get out of his chair. He simply raised his wobbly head and stared in confusion at the sea of horrified faces. The promotion was canceled, of course, and he was sent back to his former post, there to spend the rest of his days with the corporation, unfortunately. It's important to be relaxed when we make a presentation, but it's a special kind of relaxation. It comes from preparation, from knowing the subject, and from being well qualified to speak on it. Now, that includes being alert and sharp. Perry Como, of all the great performers of the past two or three decades, achieved fame not only for his acknowledged talent as a singer and performer, but for his wonderful presence in front of an audience. Bing Crosby is the same way. But Perry Como appeared to be as relaxed and as at home as he would be in his own living room with his family. He gave the impression of enjoying himself in an easygoing, smiling, and relaxed way. He would be my choice as a model worth emulation. We might never achieve his accomplishments in a relaxation department, but we can work toward them. When you get up to give your speech, think of Perry Como appearing before the television cameras and the studio audience, smiling, warm, friendly, and with the talent and hours of rehearsal to give an excellent accounting of himself. He was, and still is on his rare appearances, completely unself-conscious. He doesn't think about himself at all, or at least that's the impression we get. He's thinking only of his audience, what he's doing, and the other people on his show. Now, if we can do the same thing, we'll do a great job. If we can forget ourselves and think only of the audience and our subject, what we're trying to say, to convey, to sell to that group of people, we'll do a very good job indeed. To be self-conscious is to put yourself ahead of the audience and your subject. You're filled with yourself and how you appear, how you sound, how you forget you. Think of two factors. Your audience first, pleasing and informing them, and your subject. Handling it properly, doing it well. You'll come through fine if you succeed in doing that. It's the mark of the star. I remember the first time I saw Barbara Streisand. She was just a youngster on her first television appearance, and I remember yet how she sold that song. She gave me goose flesh as she sang that song with all her heart, and I remember saying to my wife at the time, long before she'd finished the number, that girl is going to be a very big star. There were a few million other people all over the country saying the same thing. A homely, gawky little girl under the spell of that music became beautiful, and all we knew who were watching and listening was that we had never heard that song sung like that before. Barbara Streisand's and Perry Como's are, to be sure, anomalies, few and far between, like 50-carat diamonds. But if we want to be good at what we do, it pays to emulate the best. And the way to do that is to forget ourselves. The same is true of all great salesmen. They're not thinking of themselves, their commissions, or sales records. When they're in front of a customer, they're thinking of him and their product or service as an aid to him. In this way, we can achieve what some of the top athletes have called controlled relaxation. It comes from concentrating on the ball, in our case the speech, and where we want it to go, in our case the audience. Everything else will then fall into place. It doesn't mean that we lose track of time and talk too long. We can check that as we go along. It doesn't mean that we forget to use the mic properly and look at the people in our audience. We can do all those things if we're ready, if we know what we're going to say, and if we're sober and sharp. Being good at anything demands sacrifices of various kinds. It certainly applies to this curious business of standing up in front of the room and talking to a group of people. Thank you. I'll never forget one Saturday afternoon. I was picked up at 6:45 at my home and driven to a hotel where the meeting was to be held, to which I had been asked to speak. It was a very hot day in the middle of summer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The man who picked me up had his girlfriend with him. He was driving a two-door Volkswagen. An old gentleman asks a girl to climb into the back seat, so I climbed through a maze of straps of various kind and wedged my big frame into the space available. The car was like an oven. As we started along the road, I noticed that it wasn't getting any cooler. My collar was wilting and the knot on my tie was getting soaked, as was my shirt. How about some air conditioning? I ventured. Sorry, came the cheerful rejoinder. It doesn't work. Perhaps we should take my car, I offered. We were still just a block or two from my home. Oh, no, my cheerful driver protested. I've been appointed to be your chauffeur. Arriving at the meeting room in an old, dilapidated hotel, I saw, much to my compounding exasperation, that they had the kind of public address system you sometimes get in a box of Cracker Jacks. Not only was it of the nickel-and-dime variety, it was a stand mic, an upright stand mic that must be placed at one side of the lectern, so that the speaker has to speak with his head turned sharply to one side. He can't see his audience, and they get the impression he's paralyzed. Even from that distance across the room, I could see that it was one of those blasted things that one has to practically swallow to be picked up, that makes all the P's pop and distorts the voice so that it's difficult to understand. There was no light on the lectern for notes that might be used, and it was stuck in a dark corner of the room. It was one of those nights. When, after my talk, a smiling man came up to the head table and, after introducing himself, commented that he had been in charge of the meeting, I felt that if there were indeed such a thing as justifiable homicide, surely this was the time. His idea of being in charge of a meeting is to notify the people who are expected to attend and have his secretary arrange for a room someplace, any place. A poorly prepared meeting can virtually ruin a good speech and destroy the customary equanimity of the most benign speaker. It tells the speaker that someone didn't consider his appearance there very important. I should not have had to climb into the back seat of a hot two-door coupe nor ride in an unair-conditioned car. The public address system should be first class and in good working order. The microphone should be the gooseneck variety, which is attached to the back of the lectern and be adjustable for the speaker, and with enough pickup to allow him to speak in a normal tone, not lean over and see and glance at all of his audience. Sometimes a speaker likes to use a lavalier microphone, especially if he's going to move about or use a chalkboard or flip chart. That should be checked by the person arranging for the meeting. The microphone should be carefully tested and the volume adjusted before the meeting. Someone who knows what he's doing should be ready to ride the game so that the speaker will be heard effectively. He may not, and probably will not, speak at the same volume as the person who introduces him. Someone should be ready to set the game at the new level. There should be a light on the lectern, or enough light for the speaker to use notes if he chooses to do so. Everything should be done to make the speaker feel comfortable and welcome. He shouldn't even have to think about the equipment. He should be able to concentrate on his speech. When I arrived at the meeting that day I was talking about earlier, we were the first ones there. I had to stand around for an hour before the tables filled and I could take my seat at the head table. I should have been brought in near the last minute, or at best 15 minutes or so before the speech. I should have been asked whether or not I wanted to be present for the cocktail hour. I didn't want to be there for it. I can't drink before a speech. It slows down my mental processes. And to stand around for an hour while everyone else is drinking is an awful imposition. I did the best I could, considering the condition I was in and the dumb equipment. In fact, I opened with a brief recital of my being picked up in an unair-conditioned Volkswagen, the straps and so on, and had the audience convulsed with laughter, those that could hear me with my head and neck twisted like that. If you're placed in charge of a meeting, work up a checklist and go over it carefully. You should, by all means, see to the care, comfort, and feeding of your main speaker, especially if he's from out of town. He should be met at the airport and driven in a comfortable car to his hotel, where he should have been checked in advance and the proper billing arranged for. He should be questioned as to when he wants to come to the meeting and if he needs any sort of special equipment. Actually, this sort of information should be obtained at the time the speech is first arranged, so that all necessary preparations can be made in plenty of time. Check and double-check the public address system. It should be of first quality, even if you have to junk what's there and rent some good stuff. Make the speaker happy, and you'll get a better speech for your money. All it takes is a little empathy. Think how you'd feel and what you'd want if you were the speaker. Another pet peeve of mine is when the person who introduces me does so all bent over with his mouth against the microphone. Now, does he expect me to talk for 45 minutes in that position? And doesn't he realize that the volume set for that sort of bad microphone use won't work for a professional who stands back the correct distance from the mic? I think all officials of all meetings should take a course in how to use a public address system. And all hotels who want to develop meeting business should see to it that their equipment is of the very best. It will give them good service and happy meetings for many, many, many years, and repeat customers as well. The first time I spoke at Carnegie Hall, I was in for a bad time. The podium was excellent. The lectern on it was one of those electrical jobs that could be raised or lowered with the touch of a finger. There was also a frosted glass top to the thing, through which electrical messages could be flashed to the speaker. And no sooner had I begun to speak than the sign in the lectern began flashing, "Stop talking. Stop talking. Stop talking." And so we come to the end of our program on the art of ululation and peroration, of forming sounds into words and projecting them on waves of sound to the eardrums of people sitting in a group there for the purpose of hearing what we have to say. We talk of speaking with strength and effectiveness. Sometimes, particularly at the beginning of a talk, we don't feel like speaking with strength and effectiveness. In that case, we have to fake it until our confidence catches up with our acting ability. If we're going to stand up there and open our mouths, we must give the impression that we have something to say that's worth saying and hearing. It's a psychological truism, dating back to William James of Harvard, that we have only to act the part to find the power to perform the part. Act brave, and you'll be brave. Stand up and have at it, and the pieces will fall into place, and before you know it, you'll be enjoying yourself. Who knows? Maybe the audience will enjoy it, too. We talked about the importance of creativity in the preparation of our talk. It's what makes our speech unusual and perhaps even a bit memorable. One day I was including in my speech the dangers of an exponentially growing government and its concomitant costs to the taxpayer. Thinking about it, I said that the government is becoming like a very fat man in a telephone booth. There's not much room left for much else. Using a metaphor will bring your idea to life and make it memorable. Picturing a very fat man in a telephone booth gives us a very graphic idea of how a constantly swelling government can take up too much room in the national picture. It's a creative way to bring color and life to your talk. Another time, talking about the cooperation between Great Britain and France in producing the supersonic airplane, the Concorde, I said achieving an effective and friendly working relationship between those two countries was on the order of difficulty of mating a wolverine with a barnyard bull. Now, you can easily come up with original and creative metaphors to give interest and hold attention to your talk. We covered the importance of drawing one picture at a time. If you're talking about the trip you took to the Rocky Mountains, stay on that trip until it's over. Don't detour until you've completed one picture, one at a time. Which reminds me, if you do use a metaphor, stay with it. Don't mix them. Detour and trip to the Rocky Mountains work together. They both apply to taking a trip, the metaphor in this case. It would have been wrong if I had said, if you're talking about your trip to the Rocky Mountains, don't suddenly head off into left field. Baseball and a trip to the Rockies don't go together. Some mixed metaphors are hilarious, and we've all done it on occasion, but a little work and planning can avoid it. Remember we talked about the word tessellation and the putting together of all the little tiles until the mosaic is complete. It's important. One picture at a time. Then we highlighted the importance of knowing your audience and knowing what it takes to transfer the pictures in your mind into the minds of your listeners. Get to the meeting a little early and talk with the people in charge of the meeting. Even sitting in on the meeting ahead of the one you're to handle is a good idea. Then we stressed the importance of using powerful, colorful words. Not difficult, esoteric words, such as the two I used in the opening of this message, ululation and peroration. To ululate is to howl like a dog or a great ape in the forest. It's to make a lot of noise and bother everybody in the vicinity. Perorate means to speak or declaim at length, to make a speech, to bring a speech to a close with a formal conclusion. I should not have used those words had I been speaking to an audience of non-speakers, but since, as a member of Toastmasters, you're in the business, I thought I'd toss them in the hopper. Besides, you probably knew what they meant anyway. If you want to be a public speaker, make a study of the English language, vocabulary especially. A two-bit vocabulary will limit you to two-bit subjects and generally produce two-bit results. I know places in the country where it's considered a mark of manhood to have a very limited education. Fortunately, those pockets of dummies are rapidly disappearing. We think with words. If our vocabulary is limited, our thinking will be limited. When you come across a word you don't know, look it up and build a fine library of good books on the language. I must have 50 books on that subject alone, and I find new ones all the time. As we said, the language is our toolbox. The more tools, the bigger and better jobs we can handle with ease and confidence. But, and this is vital, speak in the language of your audience. Don't talk down, ever. But don't talk up, either. Never, ever try to impress your audience with your erudition. The idea is to sell them a message. You're just the messenger boy, and as such, you stay in the background like the conduits that carry the electricity to your home. The message is the thing. And while using a good array of powerful, colorful words is important, it's important that we keep them well within the realm of understanding on the part of our audience. If you're talking to a group of university English professors, that's one thing. If it's a union meeting, that's something else. Getting back to that mosaic we're trying to put together as a picture in the minds of our listeners, it's good to remember to keep things in order. If you leave blank spaces, you might never get back to fill them in. And besides, you can confuse or worse, bore your audience in that way. I talked about the preparation of a speech and mentioned my technique. In preparing a speech, I'm the Stewart type. The upcoming talk worries my mind like a puppy with a slipper. There's a good metaphor. I let it cook and stew in there, knowing full well that on the morning of the day I'm to give the speech, I'll be able to sit down, and it will practically write itself. Then, all I need are main point notes or reminders to keep on track. Then, once again, just before the speech, I go over it carefully again, sometimes adding a note or two or something that's happened in the meeting and the name of the person who's to introduce me, and I'm all set. Sometimes it involves a great deal of research and reading. Fine. And we can make notes as we read. The important thing is not to get to the point where we think no preparation is necessary. That works with speakers in the same way that it works with athletic teams. They lose. As to visual aids, if they'll help the talk, fine, use them. If not, don't haul them in. They're not needed. We talked about the fact that there are no small parts, just small actors. There's no such thing as an unimportant speech. I'll spend as much or more time preparing a high school commencement speech as I will a speech before thousands of adults. Keep tuned for feedback. Be sensitive to your audience. Not too sensitive or worried, but aware of how the audience is responding to what you're saying. Remember your manners. You're a guest, and the people in the audience should be treated with care and respect. It's important to like your audience. Concentrating on liking the people in your audience just before you go on will help get rid of nervousness and stage fright. Think of Perry Como when you get up to that microphone. Picture how relaxed a person can be and still be the star of the show, still put on a great performance. Don't assume your audience knows what you're talking about. To get the pictures out of your head and into their heads, you must explain them clearly. And try imagining at times that you're sitting out there in the audience. Get on their side of the microphone and speak to them as you would want to be talked to. By doing that, you can do a better job of selling, of getting those good people to buy what you're talking about. We talked about the importance in good conversation to use the tennis technique, that is, to hit the ball back and forth to include the other person in the game and give him an equal and fair share of time and conversation. It's also important when talking to a group. Look at them, pause for effect, gauge their response, ask questions, get the heads nodding or shaking, whichever you're trying for, get them in the act. Don't be like the golfer who just keeps hitting his own ball over and over and over again. Then, if you're given the job of preparing for a meeting, put yourself in the shoes of the speaker. See that everything is taken care of and that there are no slip-ups. In particular, check the PA system. Make sure it's the right kind of microphone and that it works well. And that's about it, my friend. I hope you've enjoyed our visits together. I must say that I've enjoyed doing this program more than any other I've ever prepared. I love this subject. It's an important subject. We kid about it at times, but talking to people in groups is an important part of our culture. Knowing how to do it well is a tremendous asset. And besides, as Mark Twain said of it, it's a lot better than working for a living. Thank you.